It was a battle for a good solid 3 hours or so, and it was supported by air tankers dropping loads of retardants right next to the houses.
The fight to save structures from the Card Street fire. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, donations for victims of the wildfires are piling up, and not always in a good way.
Probably the thing that's too much of right now is clothing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Firefighters are reporting good progress on the Sockeye fire near Willow. Public Information Officer Ada Takis says the 7,500-acre fire does not appear to have grown today, and firefighters are all the way around the perimeter, working to put out hot spots. She says they will advance into the interior of the fire as they can to address other hot spots or areas that may be burning underground. The fire is still considered at zero containment, but that may start to change later tonight and into tomorrow. Evacuations are still in place, red flag warnings remain, and Takis says the thundercells that passed over the area last night did not drop any rain on the fire. The Card Street fire near Sterling on the Kenai Peninsula is now at 2,500 acres. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
The good news on the Card Street fire is that it's finally beginning to move away from residential areas on the banks of the Kenai River. Easterly winds are pushing the fire into the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge and Skelak Lake. Division of Forestry spokesperson Terry Anderson says favorable winds, a lot of water, and good preparation by property owners kept the damage limited to just one structure Tuesday night.
The fire made a major run to the west. It kind of, the wind swirled around, and so it jumped Kenai Keys, came into the subdivision with lots of sparks and embers and trees torching in the area. And so it was a battle for a good solid 3 hours or so. And it was supported by air tankers dropping loads of retardants right next to the houses. You know, you'd never try to drop on a house, but they were definitely right next to houses trying to support the firefighters. And a lot of success.
At least 300 people have been evacuated. Campgrounds near Skelak Lake have also been cleared out, and Anderson says the Type 2 management team will arrive Monday with extra administrative and ground support.
There's a lot of tired firefighters out there right now, so to be supplemented by a management team or to be supplemented by more fire crews is what we all need right now, and that's happening. We have about 120 firefighters, new ones, hit the ground today. More have been ordered.
The forecast for the peninsula calls for more hot, dry, windy weather, and officials expect these fires to continue through the week. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Lightning strikes are thought to be the cause of two new fires that started yesterday near the Kenai Peninsula community of Cooper Landing. Both fires are at 0% containment. KBVI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
The first, called the Stetson Creek Fire, was reported to state troopers just after 6 p.m. It's burning on very steep terrain, and erratic winds overnight caused it to grow quickly. Mona Spargo is a public affairs specialist with the Forest Service.
The good news is that it was originally estimated at 750 to 1,000 acres, and they've been able to look at it a little closer, and it's now 250 to 300.
An initial attack crew and volunteer fire department from Cooper Landing and Moose Pass worked through the night.
It is south of the Sterling Highway between Russian River and Cooper Creek. Right now, there's no imminent threat to structures. However, it is close to the Cooper Creek campground, which has been closed. I mean, it's been evacuated, and that's not because of fire danger right there. That's just because we need it for logistics and for doing fire line and some of that.
The second fire, called the Juneau Lake Fire, was noticed by troopers and reported in just after 7 p.m. It's burning up by tree line, but expanded overnight toward a wetter area and hasn't grown much above the 60 acres it had reached by this morning.
It's east of Juneau Lake, kind of north of Cooper Landing. It's in between the Romig and Juno cabins on Resurrection Pass Trail.
Additional response teams have been requested and are expected to arrive later this evening. The forest and the nearby community of Cooper Landing have a lot of tourism activity in the summer months as a prime recreational spot near the Kenai River. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Lightning ignited two new wildfires east of Delta Junction last night. Fairbanks Delta Area State Fire Management Officer Ed Sanford says the blazes near the small community of Healy Lake resulted from numerous lightning strikes. He says air tankers were deployed on the fires, but they were growing too aggressively to knock down.
We could not catch it, so we went into what we call point protection. So we have 16 smoke jumpers out there with some boats, setting up sprinkler systems and protecting the cabins out there.
Sanford says there are about 50 structures, including many recreational cabins, in the fire area. He says an incident management team is taking over the fires, which have burned together and are estimated at about 900 acres. So far this year, about 78,000 acres have burned in 280 fires in Alaska. That may sound like a lot, but it's actually below normal. That's according to Pete Buist, a public information officer for the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center. Buist has worked on fires in Alaska and the rest of the country for 48 seasons. Buist says the fire season in the state usually unfolds in a predictable pattern.
Early in the season, we have a lot of fires that are human-caused. And then as the season progresses, we get into the time of year when lightning is common. And that happens, well, frankly, about now. It's actually a little late this year. So we're on the low side in terms of numbers of starts and numbers of acres.
Is that surprising, given how dry? We didn't have a lot of snow last winter. It was a dry spring. Were you anticipating that it would be worse by this time?
We have folks, it's called the predictive services section, who do calculations and computer models and that sort of thing. And they had predicted a pretty busy season, not just here in Alaska, but you know, all through the lower 48. That has not transpired so far. But interestingly, for example, this is very much the way 2004 started out, which ended up being our record year with somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 million acres burning in Alaska alone.
Are there signs that we could be heading towards something similar?
I don't think so. I mean, we're busy right now. We're not as busy as we get, but we're busy, and the lightning season's coming on, and we're obviously going to get busier for a while. But despite the dire predictions, there's really no way to accurately come up with what's going to happen next week, even. Much less what's going to happen next month. And normally, by a month from now, our fire season is pretty much over.
Pete, what about the location of the fires? Are there more fires burning farther south this year?
That is something that I've observed, is that there's a little more activity in south-central Alaska. Normally, places like the Kenai and the Mat-Su, the fire danger is the greatest between breakup and green up, and when we've got wind in the spring and that sort of thing, it's very busy down there. This year, that seems to have extended a bit further into the season.
How unusual is it to have several fires threatening primary structures?
It's fairly unusual in Alaska, just because we don't have that many built-up areas.
We saw burn bans coming out, being put in place just yesterday, which seems puzzling. In a dry spring and early summer like this, why isn't most of the state under a burn ban already?
Well, because the conditions vary from one place in the state to another. And until we have a problem, we don't like to restrict people. If it gets to the point where our initial attack resources are a little thin, and we're really adamant that we don't need any more new starts, You know, we don't like to tell people, no, you shouldn't burn, or you can't do this, or you can't do that. People in Alaska are better than people lots of places about not doing unsafe things. So, I mean, we'd rather not restrict people. But when it gets to the point where we have to, we will.
That's an interesting point that you made, that people here seem to be more fire aware and make better decisions as far as making sure their campfires are out and that sort of thing. Is that what you're saying?
That's been my experience. You know, we all do lots of camping, lots of fishing, and we have those campfires and we know how to take care of them. But, you know, in any subset of the population, there's that, you know, few percentage points of folks who are not that careful, and they're the ones that cause the problems.
Pete Buist is a public information officer with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a contentious meeting between the Navy and Homer residents over the Northern Edge training exercise.
We gave them some information and then we were able to listen. I think we got a pretty good amount of feedback.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Wildfires are breaking out across wide swaths of the state, and combating them involves a mix of local, state, and federal resources. But as KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, amid the organizational complexities, most of the immediate needs on the ground are quite basic.
A level below ground in the National Guard Armory, the state's Emergency Operations Center is a hive of computer monitors and telephone calls.
Our job is not to fight fires.
Michael O'Hare directs the state's Emergency Management Division.
So our job is to make sure the firefighters are putting the fires out. The next phase is the what we call the start of our disaster assistance, the recovery process.
Frontline firefighting is overseen by the Forestry Service. They're the ones calling in crews of hotshots or phoning in to the National Guard for helicopters. But here, the Operations Center feels like a big tent, with representatives fielding phone calls and connecting folks in the Matsu or Kenai boroughs with the things they need right now.
Cots and blankets and pillows and sanitation kits, health kits, toothbrushes and toothpaste.
The division also helps assess damage. That phase started today in the valley, as borough officials went out with state troopers to do quick checks on which properties are damaged. That information will eventually be used by the state in providing funds to homeowners for repairs and bringing in federal FEMA money if the destruction is beyond the borough or state's ability to pay. At the center of all of this is Brian Fisher, who wears a red vest so that officials from a wide array of outside agencies know he's part of the emergency management team. Fisher says his job is simple: support the local jurisdictions.
Natural disasters are always very expensive, particularly in Alaska.
In a complicated crisis situation, just having the room and the know-how to coordinate is key. Emergency managers handling the wildfires are on call for 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. Fisher says just having the capacity to navigate all the available resources frees up frontline crews dealing with everything from fire suppression to evacuations.
The state of Alaska does not forcibly evacuate anybody from anywhere. If the homeowner or the resident chooses not to leave, they take their information down on where they are, who they are, and next of kin to be able to notify if something, God forbid, which should happen.
That just sounds like a crazy conversation to have potentially with a stranger of, we need your next of kin, and then you're on your own and Godspeed.
It's very, very difficult and challenging. The firefighter's primary mission is to save lives and protect property, and having to be a stranger to come in to say, we need you to leave now, and if you don't, you're on your own, because we have to go save, protect ourselves and protect all the rest of the property and homeowners in the area where the fire is very, very difficult conversations to have.
Officials and relief workers say the donations that help them most at this point are cash that can be spent at shelters in the valley and on the Kenai. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Donations for those affected by the wildfires are piling up, but not all charity is equal when it comes to having the best impact. Relief agencies helping the state manage shelter and aid refer to something called the disaster within the disaster. What they mean is that well-meaning Alaskans rush out to donate goods that end up being more of a burden than a help.
Probably the thing that's too much of right now is clothing.
Tom Gemmel works with the Red Cross, which is helping take care of the more than 90 evacuees staying at a shelter in Houston. Gemmel says they and other groups like the Salvation Army connect individuals with particular needs, like eyeglasses, medications, and short-term housing. But they do it through gift certificates and deals with hotels, which depend on cash. If you want to help but don't feel comfortable opening your wallet, put away the canned green beans and old bedding. Gemmel has other advice.
The best thing people can do is, one, prepare their own families for a disaster, because you're pretty useless as a disaster volunteer if you're worried about your own family.
Once the state begins its damage assessment phase, officials will have a clearer picture of specific needs. The state Supreme Court heard arguments in a local boundary case this morning that could redraw lines around a Delaware-sized chunk of southeast Alaska. The contested land is almost completely uninhabited national forest. Juneau estimated the population at 1. But with the land goes potential federal receipts, some property and sales tax revenue, and local authority. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has more on the local boundary commission case that's pitted Juneau against Petersburg.
Within 5 minutes of Juneau's attorney beginning her arguments in the Alaska Supreme Court, Chief Justice Dana Fabe interrupted with this question.
Given that the LBC has the discretion not to consolidate and has even the discretion whether to consider relevant information from concurring or conflicting petitions, and given that you haven't challenged the constitutionality of that regulation or even challenged the LBC's exercise of its discretion in how it proceeded, why doesn't that end the case?
There's a lot of technical legal stuff that could be unpacked in that question, but the takeaway is that Fabe was wondering out loud if Juneau had a case at all. The boundary beef stems from Petersburg's dissolution as a city and reincorporation as a geographically much bigger borough in 2013. Its northern border now comes to Holcomb Bay, where Tracy and Endicott Arms empty into Stevens Passage. The usual authority on these matters, the state's local boundary commission, cut about 500 square miles of land around Tracy Arm from Petersburg's original annexation request. It was a concession to Juneau, where tourism connections made it a better fit, commissioner said. But Juneau wants an additional 1,500 square miles excluded from the Petersburg borough and argues it has better claims to those lands and waterways that weren't properly considered by the commission. Mead noted the commission itself supported Juneau in the contested area in a boundary study last revised in 1997. The justices asked several questions trying to parse out exactly what Juneau alleges the local boundary commission did wrong. Eventually, Juneau attorney Amy Mead summed it up like this.
What we're saying is that the analysis that they engaged in, which is apparent from a reading of that decisional document, was constitutionally infirm. That is our argument.
She argued the analysis was weak, specifically with respect to Article 10, Section 3 of the state constitution that says, each borough shall embrace an area and population with common interests to the maximum degree possible.
Article 10 is properly understood as a rough guideline.
That's State Attorney Janelle Hafner representing the Local Boundary Commission.
It is not a rigid blueprint. It is not a standalone fixed mandate that directs what a borough boundary must look like at any one point. Nor does it direct the manner in which the commission evaluates the decision about which boundary among competing boundaries is the best fit.
She and Jim Brennan, the attorney for Petersburg, both argued that the commission properly weighed the competing claims and acted within its authority. Brennan took particular offense to Juneau's assertion that the commission limited its participation in the annexation proceedings. He noted a 58-page report by the Juneau Economic Development Council.
That was considered. Petersburg rebutted it. Petersburg went through a point-by-point rebuttal of that study and also showed that Petersburg's commercial fisheries connections with the area were substantially greater.
Petersburg fishermen are responsible for more than 90% of the commercial haul from the contested area. Juneau businesses and residents own most of the private land. The commission also held a 3-day hearing in Petersburg on the competing annexations in 2012 that Brennan attended.
I must have been at a different proceeding than is discussed by Juneau, the main question was, who's got the greater connections, Juneau or Petersburg? That's what the hearing was all about. Juneau brought down 10 witnesses. They had essentially a full day to present testimony on this point, and they were not precluded from presenting anything.
Justice Craig Stowers asked, if Juneau prevails, what can the court do to satisfy Juneau? Mead said Juneau does not want to force Petersburg to revert to city status, but the court could order the commission to revisit the competing annexation claim with more evidence and more hearings. The court usually publishes its decisions within 9 months of hearing arguments. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Groundwater contamination at Eielson Air Force Base has spread off the facility. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a chemical thought to originate from firefighting foam is being detected in groundwater wells in a nearby subdivision.
Perfluorinated or PFAS compounds have been detected in private wells in the Moose Creek neighborhood along the Richardson Highway near Eielson. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Contaminated Sites Program Specialist Eric Breitenberger says the DEC has received test results back on 57 Moose Creek area wells.
46 out of the 57 wells have tested at or above the public health advisory level for PFAS.
Breitenberger says results from additional wells tested have not come back yet. He estimates there could be as many as 150 drinking water wells in the Moose Creek area. Last month, the Air Force announced groundwater testing showed some base wells to be contaminated in excess of the health advisory level, raising concern about off-site migration. Eielson spokesman Lieutenant Elias Zani says that prompted the Air Force to offer Moose Creek residents well testing.
And you know, if they come back above the provisional health advisory level, we are providing bottled drinking water.
Lieutenant Zani says the Air Force is coordinating the response with state and federal agencies. Alaska Department of Health Officer Sandrine DeGlan says the human health risk is unclear as perfluorinated compounds are an emerging contaminant.
A few studies have been done, and they have been done on fairly large populations. And despite this, there is no convincing evidence that the chemical will cause any particular effect. That doesn't mean that it is safe. It means that further research needs to be done.
DeGlan says the existing studies are not directly comparable to the situation in Moose Creek, as they're based on health effects on large populations with low-level exposure to perfluorinated compounds through means other than drinking water.
PFOS is present around us in furniture, in carpet, or different products that we use pretty much on a daily basis. So the exposure doses are very small, and that's why it's also difficult to conduct the studies.
DeGlan says higher-level exposure studies using animals have shown liver and hormonal effects. How broad the PFLOS exposure is in the Eielson area hinges on groundwater spread. The DEC's Breitenberger says the drainage is generally northwest, away from populated areas.
We don't know exactly how far down gradient the contamination could extend, but the good news is there are very few houses for quite a distance.
DEC representatives are joining Air Force officials at a public meeting at the Moose Creek Fire Department tonight to talk about the groundwater contamination. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Representatives of the U.S. Navy and other branches of the military visited Homer on Monday to discuss the Northern Edge exercises to take place in the Gulf of Alaska. The information session was tense. KBBI's Quentin Chandler has more.
Four representatives traveled to Homer to explain the purpose of Northern Edge. Captain Raymond Hesser is a naval officer with Alaskan Command.
We, as a team, were able to present a lot of information. If they wanted to listen to it, then, you know, I'm sure they learned something, and the whole point was an information exchange. So we gave them some information, and then we were able to listen. I think we got a pretty good amount of feedback.
Hesser and his team explained the history of Northern Edge, the drills involved, and the equipment that would be used. They also said there wouldn't be any population-wide impacts to fish or marine mammals. Homer residents rejected that. Bob Shavelson, executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, seemed to surprise the delegation with a question on the Navy's recent legal trouble regarding exercises planned in waters near Hawaii and Southern California.
There was a court decision, a federal district court decision in April that said that the analysis, the environmental analysis they did for Hawaiian and Southern California waters was inadequate, and it was actually illegal under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and other federal laws.
Shavelson asked if the Navy violated federal law there, then what are they doing differently here? None of the speakers had an answer. Hesser says he wishes he did.
Would I have liked to have, you know, answers to every single question that was given? Yes. Have I heard that question before? Yes. Have I heard it answered before? Yes. I just would not even dare to try to answer the question when I don't personally know the answer. And we just did the best we could on very short notice to come and be as transparent as possible.
Hesser says the group only had a few days' notice to make the trip to Homer. He adds that if the same legal error were made with this study, he is sure they would face a similar court ruling.
That's not an answer to the question, but I understand that they're different. And so I just try to point that out.
Dr. Cynthia Ledoux-Bloom is a fisheries scientist in California who has worked with the Navy in the Gulf of Alaska. But she says she's only given the supplemental EIS for Northern Edge a brief read. Ledoux-Bloom thinks there were good points raised at the meeting, like why the Trustee Council data on herring didn't make it into the Navy's impact study.
I don't know if the data was available between 2008 and 2011, and if it was, it should, in my opinion, have been included.
But she also believes there's a gap between people's expectations and what is actually possible. For instance, she doesn't know how to figure out if there's a positive relationship between fish mortality and exercises the Navy will be doing in the Gulf.
Were there fish before the training operations? Were there fish after the training operations? Did the training operations themselves remove the fish? If the fish died, did they float? Did they sink? Were they dead and just picked up by shorebirds? So I think like trying to figure out, you know, like mortality, you know, and making a causational relationship is I don't know how to do it.
Hesser says he appreciates the community's concerns and he wishes he could have come to Homer to start a dialogue months before Northern Edge got underway. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shady Grove Oliver and Quentin Chandler in Homer, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Nana and Tech, partners in the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.